Hi everyone, welcome to our SharePoint at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert, or SME Roundtable. I'm Daniel Cumner and I'll be your host today. We are the IT Showcase team and we love to talk with you about how Microsoft does IT. Today we have the IT experts that build, deploy and manage SharePoint solutions here at Microsoft. This SME Roundtable is your opportunity to ask direct questions and receive candid answers. Before we get started, we would like to learn a little bit about you. Please take a moment to tell us in the Bing Pulse window how much of your SharePoint infrastructure is on-premise versus in the cloud. And while you're entering your responses, let's ask our SMEs to introduce themselves. Let's start over here on my right.
Good morning. My name is Jonathan Lewis. I'm a senior IT service manager for the collaboration technologies internally here at Microsoft. And my team actually was responsible for migrating us SharePoint to the cloud. So we have a lot of great experience to share there.
My name is Jared Shockley. I'm a senior service engineer within Microsoft IT. I was a part of the SharePoint custom portals team that manage our large portals and help migrate many of them to the cloud. My current position, I'm also helping the whole part of my team moving to Azure into the cloud as well.
All right, I'm Darren Moffitt, service engineer focusing on SharePoint and Office 365 core services and automation. So a lot of the automation that our teams and employees across Microsoft leverage, I've helped write and deploy in some way.
Hi, my name is Sam Crudson. I'm a senior program manager here in Microsoft IT. My focus areas are in enterprise discovery, you know, things like enterprise search and Delve, as well as user profiles and publishing.
Thank you, everyone. So the opportunity is there for you to start asking questions now in the IM window. We're going to do our best to get through all of the questions in this hour. However, if we don't, we're going to stay behind in the studio after the live broadcast and continue to answer your questions. This video with the extended footage will be posted soon after at microsoft.com/IT Showcase. So let's get started with the question and answer portion of our show. So, first question coming in, what are some of the new things coming out of Azure that we plan on leveraging? Jared, would you like to take that?
Sure. Azure, as everybody knows, is continuing to change on almost a daily basis, and it offers a lot of services for not only SharePoint, but a lot of services in IT. One of the biggest things that we're starting to take advantage of is being able to run applications there instead of on the SharePoint servers. So we're creating applications running in the cloud that the SharePoint servers don't actually have to host. It allows us to be more agile and flexible in those applications while at the same time leverage the SharePoint APIs and security systems. It's been a big boon for Microsoft IT as we've been moving forward into the cloud as we start moving a lot of our applications from on-prem to the cloud.
And I'd add a little bit to that as well. You know, in my team, we're really looking at ways that we could leverage things like App Insights. App Insights being a tool that can be used for a lot of things. In our case, we'd use it as another way to augment the web metrics that come in the product. It'd be a good way to collect clicks, you know, figure out what parts of the sites are being used and how and who are using it for that matter. So that's one thing that we're exploring in our space and I think has a really lot of headroom for us to leverage.
Wonderful. How do we ensure everyone at Microsoft can access SharePoint online from day one at the company? Darren?
Okay. Well, this is where our Office 365 core automation comes into play. On day one, when an employee account gets created, it goes in our on-prem Active Directory, it syncs up to Azure Active Directory, and it's at that point where the magic happens. So we'll take the Azure Active Directory object for the employee and ensure that it gets a SharePoint Online license, it gets licenses for all the other products that they'll be using for their day-to-day productivity. So by the time they get onto their laptops, they're already able to access Office 365. The other piece is we do a lot of self-service. So we have an internal application we wrote called AutoSites. AutoSites allows employees to grab site collections and have them created to their specification on demand, all from day one, the minute they hit the ground running.
And I suspect a lot of people might be interested to know, Darren, you know, what technologies did we use to do the licensing? Because that's a common problem I've heard from a lot of enterprises.
Yeah. So we started with Microsoft PowerShell using the SPO management shell and the Azure Active Directory Management shell. We've since evolved to writing a C# application that is available on MSDN for anybody that's interested in looking at the source code. We've moved to C#. The C# application still does make some calls to the back end of PowerShell, but it's predominantly leveraging the new Graph API that you've heard so much about.
How do you make sure older sites that are no longer used are removed to avoid your implementation bloating or getting stale? So, Jonathan, maybe this
I'll
one
I'll take
for you.
That one. Yeah, that starts to kind of get into the governance space. You really do need to have a strong governance program in place, or you will get the bloating. We have an ingrown tool that I used to call it Microsoft Secret Sauce. That we had that was only available internally for a long time, but is actually now available, I believe, out on GitHub, but I'm not 100% sure. But it is available now to customers. It's a great tool. It actually rides in Azure, as we were talking about earlier. When we do the self-service and somebody creates a brand new SharePoint online site, then it sets an expiry date. So they have to update it every year if they want to keep that site. If they don't, then AutoSites automatically flags it. And then eventually we will go ahead and archive and delete it. And it's extremely important to do that. We also have a lot of other governance available in that particular tool. It allows us to make sure that people are following best practices and are rights management protecting sensitive data. So there's a whole lot of governance applications that are built into that particular tool. But yeah, that's primarily what we do is. Because it is pretty easy. Well, the other thing actually, when they create a brand new site, we actually require that they have two site collection owners. One has to be a full-time employee, because that is a problem. We have people come and go, and sites do get orphaned. So, but this tool actually allows us to go out, and if it is no longer being used, then we can actually automate having it archived.
And I'd probably add on a little bit there too, that there's some exciting things happening in the box space. The product group has been listening to us for years about the things that we feel that we had to do in order to make governance work within the product. And what's really kind of exciting is they've built a lot of these things into the product. So if you're a business that maybe doesn't have the resources, the manpower to build something, you can do things like classification of your sites. We call it internally HBI, MBI, LBI, high business, medium business, and low business impact. But also you can do that in the product now. And so we're starting to see that roll out, and something you can take advantage of in your environment as well.
And I just thought of something, one other thing, sorry. When you move to the cloud, that's actually an incredibly great time to clean up your environment. So one of the things I really recommend is you go out and audit your environment and encourage your employees as you're moving to the cloud to actually clean up, and that way you're not migrating a bunch of useless data.
I think we got a question there. What was the name of that tool?
AutoSites.
AutoSites. Very cool. Another question coming in. Can you explain how Office 365 group permissions and SharePoint site permissions will interact once sites are automatically created with the creation of an Office 365 group? Will they be managed separately or be dependent upon each other?
Who wants to take that
one? Do you want to take that one?
So at its core, an Office 365 group will have a security group principle in Azure Active Directory. So the question is, it can be both. When it creates the SharePoint site, of course, the group will have permissions to that site. But additionally, the Office 365 group will have that security principle that will let you permission it to other SharePoint sites, as well as other resources within Office 365. So I guess the answer to that one is all and separate.
Yeah, it can be separate. I'll just augment. So for example, if you wanted to grant someone access to the SharePoint piece of the group, without necessarily giving them access to all the other things that the group can interact with, stuff in Yammer, the stuff in Exchange, and whatnot, you can still add your own security groups, create an Active Directory, Azure Active Directory, and indeed you can even add individual users. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. You can do it both ways.
Yep.
And that also ties back, like Darren said, to other tools like Power BI. I know is heavily utilizing the Office 365 groups to be able to publish specific dashboards to a specific group of people in that manner.
Perfect.
Great. If you have critical workflow applications involving email, how do you ensure no workflow is in an arid state too long and that the customer knows what to do about it?
Ooh, it's a tricky one.
It's always a tricky one.
who wants to touch that one?
People are going to ask the tricky questions.
Exactly. A lot of times, this is one of, I find, the weaknesses of the workflow management system within SharePoint has always been, when it gets into an arid state, how do you handle it? Because most of the time with an arid state, you have to dive into the ULS logs to find the exact error. And it makes it difficult because a normal user can't do that. You have to be an administrator to have access to those ULS logs. One of the things that I've been pushing personally is moving to tools like Logic Apps in Azure or the new Flow tool, because the users can actually troubleshoot and see the error messages themselves and be able to do a lot more troubleshooting than before. And they've actually gotten better connectivity than the workflow managers.
Yeah, I would add on. I think Jared's right, spot on here. What's really exciting about Flow is it can do a lot of the same, not everything to be sure, but it can do a lot of the same things that SharePoint workflow can do historically, while also adding connectivity across apps. Detect a post in Yammer, write that to a SharePoint list, see a file uploaded into Box, copy that file from Box over to a SharePoint site collection. So, for some scenarios, that's mm-hmm. one way to go about it, but I don't think we have a really great answer on the SharePoint piece, because that's a challenge we face as well.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Just a quick update on the poll, and this is great information for us so that we can focus those answers. We're looking at around 33% completely on-premise, 30% completely in the cloud, and then the other 30% in some sort of hybrid mode. So it's a great mix of customers that we have out there that are listening in today. So thank you for filling in that poll. We've got great questions coming in, so keep those coming in the chat window. The next one we have here is, how do you keep up with the change management for new features that are coming out rapidly and informing employees of those changes?
That's always been a difficult thing. even we've gotten surprised at times with seeing new technologies all of a sudden show up. A video was a good one. I know that surprised a lot of us the first day. Yeah. The big thing is to make sure you have the first user ring enabled.
First release,
thank you. Yeah. First release enabled so that you can see those things. Have a small group that's not just IT, but also bring in your power users that are the users out in the field. We internally at Microsoft, we have a users group that meets, that we talk to about all those features. And it's been super helpful in getting the word out to the power users as to stuff that's coming. So yeah, that's been helpful for us.
I think another important piece of that is we have to have a very strong relationship with our product group who actually manages SharePoint in the cloud for us. We really need to make sure that they understand if there's going to be something new added into the mix, that we are aware of it, because we do have a very stringent change process. We have both a client change process and an infrastructure change process. So we need to know when those changes are coming ahead of time so we can actually get it through that process. So we really have to maintain that strong relationship with our product group.
And I'll add on, I guess I can't help but add on every question, I'm sorry. So the thing I'd add on here is we have a program internally called Microsoft Elite. For a lot of the features that we know are coming, we have a team which reaches out to motivated end users internally. And these are the folks who have expressed a willingness, a desire to try out the latest and greatest, give us an IT feedback, give intern product group feedback on the new features. And that's something we use heavily in a lot of our areas, although like I think we said, it does still sometimes come up and surprise us.
Yeah, it's a great call out.
Awesome. So we've got a question here from someone who perhaps knew how things used to work in Microsoft a while ago. We used to have a workflow tool that provisioned team sites. How are you controlling the approval process for the new Office 365 groups and team sites? And the follow-up to that is, if Office 365 group creation is restricted, the owner is not able to manage the group's membership.
I don't think we are actually controlling the Office 365 groups creation at the moment. It is a discussion we're still having internally over the overall lifecycle management of it, as well as to ensure that Office 365 groups remain in compliance with Microsoft security and legal best practices. But at the moment, we've been letting our employees just go wild with the new features. They can create the Office 365 groups as they will, and they have full control over it. I don't believe with our automation that we're anticipating on restricting that. We'll be mostly focusing more on the top-level lifecycle management. weeding out stale groups, making sure that groups are classified based on the type of data they might be sharing. That will probably be the extent of what we'll be managing here at Microsoft.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a cultural thing, really, at Microsoft. So yeah, I don't see us restricting that. We don't really have an approval process per se. It's all automated. It's all self-help. So I don't see that changing anytime soon. We do have auditing and other things in place, like
Compliance Center.
Compliance Center. DLP, which is data loss prevention. That can go out and flag sensitive data and make sure that we're not doing anything stupid there. So, or people aren't using dirty words in the names of their URLs or things like that. So we do kind of, that's about the extent to which we actually really, monitor the environment.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we're responsible as part of IT is to get in front of the technology and maybe stress it out, if possible, before our customers do. So, one of the best ways to do that is just open the floodgates.
Yeah.
And see how many groups can be created and see what sort of fun we can get our management team into mm-hmm. for that.
Exactly.
So another question here. What's the best practice for SharePoint app developers to properly test their apps on SharePoint Online, performance and load testing specifically?
Well,
good question.
It's a great question. I can take this one.
Yeah.
One of the big things for SharePoint apps is there's basically two modes of SharePoint apps when you talk SharePoint Online. There's provider-hosted apps or SharePoint-hosted. In the case of SharePoint-hosted apps, they're typically JavaScript, so there's no real load on the server other than hitting the APIs. When it comes to provider-hosted apps, you're typically hosting in some other provider like Azure, or you can even host in AWS or some other system or even a SaaS provider. And then you'd just be load testing that app over there. When it comes to the SharePoint side, those apps will typically run in some sort of iframe, or it'll launch and take over the SharePoint window after passing the permissions along. From what I understand, the SharePoint product group, if you're going to try and put a load test against the SharePoint Online product, you're probably going to get blocked because they're going to think of it as a denial of service attack.
There's a lot of throttling place, but I think the long story short is we test in production. Because of the new app model and because of the way SharePoint Online handles apps, there isn't anything server-side that we typically have to be worried about. So when I'm developing my apps for automation, I test in production, knowing that if something goes wrong, it's only affecting the specific sites that I'm testing against, of course, before I turn it on the rest of the company.
Exactly.
And
one other thing is you can also get a dev tenancy or a dev site on your tenancy,
mm-hmm.
which
like
will get you access.
Pre-production.
Yeah. That'll get you access to debugging tools. So definitely set up a test, but it's in your production tenancy.
Exactly. Testing in production used to be a huge taboo, not so much with SharePoint Online, I'm finding.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is probably a good time to drop in to the new SharePoint framework. So the new SharePoint framework, if you're not familiar with it, about a month and a half ago, we did version one. On September 21st, we actually did Rev 4, so go out and find that and learn a little bit more about it. It's very exciting. It's a way where it's our path forward for customization, really. It's the notion of a client-side web part. You're instantiating that in the browser. And what's really kind of exciting about it from a test perspective, not so much the performance and whatnot, but more about functionality, is it can be rendered entirely on the client machine without having to have a SharePoint site collection. So you can actually build your code, deploy it immediately, test it right there on your own machine, and then if it works, then deploy it up to the cloud. So that's a very exciting thing, and something I'd encourage all our devs to look into.
It's great that, with the cloud, in the past, we'd have our test beds and our test systems that, bore really no resemblance to the production environment, and now being able to do testing against our production environment is a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So another question coming in: do we have critical apps in SharePoint that require the business logic to be monitored, and what do you advise if a customer requests such monitoring?
We've got auto sites.
I'm thinking between the two of us, we have the most experience because we ran a lot of the infrastructure.
Yeah.
On the custom portal side, we did some custom monitoring using Visual Studio test suite, where you can actually track a web test, and then we put that into SCOM with a special tool. I can't remember what the tool was called, but I think it's an open source tool that we were actually able to have the SCOM tool do a execute a set of commands against the websites, and it monitored and sent back any error when that occurred.
Yeah, and on-prem, we did have a lot of synthetics, and we are still working on the synthetic story for SPO to understand more on synthetic transactions, understand when there may be performance issues in SPO that we can catch ahead of time. And I know that internally with a few of our applications, we've used a tool called App Insights. Yeah. App Insights, for instance, turned on to our AutoSites tool that we mentioned earlier, lets us understand ahead of time if there may be some performance issues, some latency, if the tool is having longer than expected call times for making certain calls to like Azure claims. We do use App Insights to kind of get a sense of whether or not their AutoSites could be heading into a bit of a storm, which of course would affect the ability to create sites in a timely manner. So yeah, App Insights is one tool we've been using.
It's an incredible tool when you tie it into any sort of development platform, either SharePoint or Azure, because you can get a lot of detail about the health of the system through that.
Great. So there's a couple of comments here in the chat windows. Someone said 99% on-prem, 1% in the cloud. So I'm assuming that question is around the mix that we have for SharePoint at the moment.
We're closer to about 97% in the cloud, and we keep people on-prem for a specific reason. We actually still have customers that are running it on-prem, so we actually need to be able to pre-test our bits before we actually push those out to customers on-prem. We do also have certainly some compliance and regulatory issues that we deal with out in Europe, Middle East and Africa, and APJ that have caused us to keep a couple of regional on-prem sites so that we don't run afoul of the local compliance officers and things like that.
Based on our Bing pulse, we've still got at least 35% of our customers
We're definitely hybrid.
On-prem.
We're definitely hybrid.
Right.
Great, thank you. When a site expires, where do you archive it to and how?
I can answer that.
Good.
So when a site expires, we do go through a deletion process. That deletion process goes through the natural recycle bin of SharePoint Online. So it's retained there for a while. On the back end, we do require a 10-year retention policy. So it does get archived as part of our data backup processes that are built into SharePoint Online. And should we ever have to recover it, we work with the Office 365 product group to recover any data that's over 90 days old.
And kind of the user experience, I call it the three strikes, you're out experience. So if your site expires and you're a site collection owner or admin, you will get an email basically saying, your site is expiring on X date, please go out and either renew it, or if you don't want the site any longer, don't take any action, and no further action is required. If they don't take any action, then they will actually get another email just saying, this is a reminder, your site will be expiring on X date, and at such time, if they don't take any action there, we will actually basically put it in read-only mode. And then we'll do one more, the third strike. That's just one last reminder to the site collection owners and admins, if they haven't taken any action, that their site will actually be locked down and go through the archive process that Darren was discussing.
And I'll add, too, that the AutoSites process you're describing will also put a little pink banner into the site collection. So even for, if someone's ignoring their email, like I imagine it's in the real world, IT departments don't always get their mails read. We're also doing that right in the context of the site collection. So when a person visits the site collection, they realize that there's an action necessary to either extend or update their owners or what have you.
And they can take action if they have important data that's out there.
Exactly.
And not have it get deleted.
It's amazing how many users are using sites that the administrators of them
aren't
necessarily aware of.
There's also sites that get used once a year.
Yeah.
And that's always a problem because they're not really looking for expiration emails. So that's one that we have to manage pretty carefully as well.
Exactly.
Excellent. Have you ever considered implementing a workflow event receiver that would forward the exception stack trace to an administrator?
I don't think we have.
Because a lot of times the administrators aren't the developers.
Yeah.
So the developers themselves may implement something like that, but we don't ourselves because when we're on-prem, we have full access to the logs, so we typically go and pull those logs for the developers. So we're typically in the log. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, the average administrator on our SharePoint is an employee, so forwarding forwarding any of the information over to them can sometimes cause a bit of confusion, where for a lot of those applications that are being developed, a lot of the developers internally do have workflows that forward any sort of specific errors. And of course, again, going back to App Insights, you know, any sort of exceptions or anything thrown, we do have those monitored and forwarded to an actual developer. Specifically to the administrators, not so much. And it's mostly just to kind of avoid confusion. They're more end user administrators and less developer administrators, at least in our mix at Microsoft.
Yeah, and I'd say in my experience, though, a lot of the bigger portals that are doing the app development and are heavily customized will have kind of their own little homegrown team, almost like a tier one, that actually is familiar with the code. Because if they have custom code and we don't know anything about that code, we can't support that site. So a lot of them, if they're going to have still customized applications, then they typically have their own support team. With developers.
With the custom portals team, we had a team that specifically monitored for those events and took care of them.
Yep.
Okay, great. So there's a question here I'm going to admit to, not sure I know what it's asking, but we'll throw it to the team anyway. how can you access ULS on O365? Now, I'm not sure if that means URLs.
Unified Logging ULS. Service. Yes.
Unified Logging Service.
See, that's why we have subject matter experts here who know these things.
I can start, and if anybody wants to jump in on this. So the short answer is, we don't. The more in-depth answer is, a lot of what you look for in the ULS is starting to surface in the Unified Logging Service that combines Exchange, Power BI, Power BI, OneDrive, Exchange, and SharePoint. So the Unified Audit Logs do allow us to look at who's uploaded, viewed files, what type of actions are being taken, what type of security adjustments are happening, what's being shared externally, who's being invited in. Basically, everything we want to know about those sites, or security or legal may want to know, or users may want to know about their own sites, the Unified Auditing Service, or the Unified Audit Logs are basically what we turn to. For any sort of in-depth, you know, correlation IDs or server-side errors, typically, because as a customer, we don't manage the server side, those particular errors haven't had as much importance as an investigation piece. It would be something that we as a customer do escalate to the product group, and then they go and investigate it on their side, and we'll usually get the issue through root cause analysis.
Exactly. I mean, the change into Office 365 is we aren't server administrators anymore. We don't have to worry about the server level problems. We don't have to patch the servers. That's one of the greatest things for us, for Darren and myself. We no longer have to patch servers as far as SharePoint servers. But when it comes to logging issues with applications, this is where the cloud app model has become a better thing. The logging is being done over with the app in Azure if it's provider hosted. Then you can put App Insights on both that as well as the SharePoint hosted apps, so you can get more in-depth logging and more in-depth debugging via App Insights and via those debugging tools than you could ever with SharePoint, especially SharePoint Online, because you don't have that access.
Yeah, and we've really taken the step, actually, as far as developing apps internally, to actually say, if you're if you're on-prem and you want to develop a full trust code application on the SharePoint servers, then your support's going to be best efforts. We're really pushing everybody to the cloud app model. Even if you're going to stay on-prem, go to the cloud app model, start looking at that now ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And the cloud app model can work perfectly with on-prem versus on cloud, the cloud servers as well. So we basically have told our users, if you create, and they do this, if you create a full trust code application, and what they do is they go out and they spend $100,000 on Mr. Bender, who comes and creates this application. Then they say, thank you very much, here's your $100,000, go away. There's never documentation. They don't understand the code. So we have a really difficult time supporting that. So we're really pushing that with our users. Go to the cloud app model. It's a much better support model, and get away from full trust code on the SharePoint servers.
And it makes upgrades and migration to the cloud so much easier.
Absolutely.
It does.
Okay, so we've got a question, a comment, and a question all in one here.
Nice.
So, JavaScript, yeah, why? I'm not sure what this is relating to.
It was really actually. I think Jared should answer this one.
No problem.
It was relating to the SharePoint applications and how they run JavaScript on the client side.
They do. JavaScript, ew. Yes, JavaScript can be a difficult language to work with. However, one of the great things about the cloud app model is you're not tied to just JavaScript. You have a variety of both languages and hosting opportunities with the cloud app model that you can take advantage of. I know people that have written applications for Office 365 that are on Ruby on Rails. So it's an amazing change in how we are in the technology today. JavaScript is great because it can run on almost every web client. I know there's probably one or two web clients out there that don't run JavaScript well, and so that might be one or two. But for the most part, JavaScript is a universal client-side code base.
And in the new SharePoint framework, sadly we don't have David Johnson here this week, who would probably go into a little bit more depth on this. But the new SharePoint framework allows you to develop in almost anything you want. Like I understand some, like the product group developed a lot of the new stuff that you see in the SharePoint home space, mm-hmm. the new publishing model with the SharePoint news that was announced here this week. That was all done in Angular. So, and not only did they build it that way, you can build that way going forward too. So I would say that if JavaScript is EU for you, then maybe Angular, maybe TypeScript, or some other, I know there's more than those. I'm just not the developer.
Yep.
Choose the way that makes sense for you. SharePoint is going to support all new ways of doing things going forward.
We can razz Jared later for bringing up JavaScript.
Great. So look, for the next couple of questions, I'm going to go into our standard spiel. I'll repeat that we are IT Showcase. So we're the internal IT organization here. We are not here to announce new functionality or new technology and those sorts of things that are coming out. But I will ask the questions. If there is something publicly that we can talk about or at least give you our opinion on, we certainly will. So the next question is, SharePoint Designer is not currently supported, right? What technology is replacing it? Is that something that we can have a comment on?
So SharePoint Designer is still actually supported. So it still works with Office 365 in its current instance and will for a little bit of time to come. But really, I think what we're starting to see is, between the new SharePoint framework, the ability to do workflows outside of Designer with using Flow and what have you, and building things in Power Apps, you're starting to see a lot of the things we used to do in SharePoint Designer are being replaced with new go-forward strategies, new technologies that will accomplish a lot of the same goals that we've done historically in SharePoint Designer without having to use SharePoint Designer. So I think, as Daniel said, we're not here to make any announcements, and I'm not even sure we're privy to this one, even if we knew the roadmap. I don't, that's for sure. But I think the signals from the product group are pretty clear. SharePoint Designer is in a maintained state right now, and the new technologies are the way of the future.
Of course, that comes at its heart is Visual Studio.
Right.
Very popular application that a lot of developers are starting to move to if they haven't been on already is Visual Studio.
Right. And the key there also is, yes, there are the larger versions of Visual Studio, like the enterprise and developer packages. There's also a base version called Visual Studio Code.
Yeah, great.
And that can that's specialized for specific installs, and I believe there's one for web/SharePoint.
Yep, and then there's a new one. There's a new module that's been recently updated, one for PowerShell as well, so it's great for any of that SPO scripting we mentioned earlier.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks. Along the same lines, maybe, is there something coming for admins to get a complete overview of the permissions across the various, and I assume they mean sites?
Site collections, yeah.
So site collections for tenant admins and those sorts of things.
It's a tricky one because, of course, I haven't seen one yet. And of course, we just mentioned not mentioning anything sort of upcoming. I know that it is a big focus for us and the product group and something we've been discussing in detail about more complexity above and beyond the permission checks and the fine-grained permission management features that are already in SharePoint Online. But I don't think we have anything we can really discuss.
The way I'd answer that one is in this way. There are a number of Microsoft Gold partners that provide solutions that will go out and interrogate your environment and can look for things such as permissions, look for things such as usage, and so on and so forth. So that's one possible answer for, I obviously don't know this scenario, but that's one possible play for the person asking the question. In addition, I would mention that our auto sites tool, It's something that matches our security classification with certain rules around groups. So for example, if you have a top secret site, something we call HBI, we limit the use of broad security groups. We yep. limit how many users. We might turn on certain security features like DRM, IRM rather.
So
you can look at that for one idea, but I think right now the best answer is there's a lot of great partners out there that play in this space.
Yeah, one thing I would mention about our rights management protection is we don't force that on our HBI sites. We do call, flag sites if they're an HBI site and they're not properly using rights management because we do require it, but we stop short of actually forcing it on those sites because we can cause a lot more problems than we'll solve. So but we do hold our users accountable when it comes to that sort of thing.
And I think that's one of the key points is in Microsoft IT, we do put a lot of the ownership back onto the site owners and the site collection administrators to manage their data. We don't have a heavy hand, but that's because we hold them responsible. If their data gets out, it's their own problem. They need to, we'll help them deal with it, but they need to protect it.
But if they're not doing the right things, we do know about it.
Yep.
So we just stop short of taking action. We will send out the three strikes you're out type of emails for sites that are not properly using rights management protection on sensitive data. And we do have a lot of sensitive data in the cloud. So we're doing some really great stuff, and so the cloud is perfectly secure for that sort of thing. One of the things, that I like to mention is we're doing our earnings release from the cloud because it allowed the earnings release people to have such better, collaboration on the documents because they're heavy co-authors. So we're actually doing that from the cloud. It doesn't get much more sensitive than that. So we're really living it.
Exactly.
Great. Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath before I ask this question because it's a long one, and I hope the answer is not, we can't comment on this. We have a highly structured team site collection architecture to minimize duplicate data and encourage teams to work globally as a team. With the self-service of Office 365 groups and team sites, we need to closely manage the sites. However, we don't have an admin center to manage the Office 365 groups and soon the associated team sites. Will we have an admin center for office groups when they are released? And will PowerShell commandlets be updated to assist the administrators with managing Office 365 groups and team sites?
Okay. I think I can take a crack at this, and I think it doesn't have to be the answer. We're not allowed to talk about it. So, yes, there will be more management features coming in the graphical user interface of the Office 365 admin portal. So you will start to see more exposure to OneDrive for Business. You'll be able to manage users' OneDrive for Business sites directly from the Office 365 admin portal. And with office groups, we mentioned earlier that there is a security principle within Azure Active Directory. That will be the entry point to manage that group. You'll be able to manage ownership, certain settings related to it. And in regards to PowerShell, yes, that's coming. The idea is, and something that we're currently testing internally, is the ability to manage non-grid sites. So think grid being SharePoint team sites and stuff you would typically classify as a standard SharePoint online site collection. Non-grid is OneDrive for Business, office groups, and any other SharePoint backend pieces that could be coming into the future. Yeah, we are going to enable commandlets that will allow you to expose and manage those Office 365 sites the same way you would a team site today. And I think that covers that. Yeah, anything?
Okay. Good questions.
It's a great question.
Thanks. Now, we may have actually answered this question, but is there a plan for detailed logs for SharePoint Online to be able or to be available for developers similar to ULS logs? This will assist in identifying and fixing bugs for a SPO app developer. I think you covered some of this, didn't you, Jerry?
I covered some of it. I don't know what the plan is, if there's going to be more detailed logs. Most of the time, the recommendation is to have a dev tenancy where you have more detailed debugging capable, as well as using something like Application Insights. Because Application Insights can actually tie deeper into systems. I believe they're also the Application Insights team is working with SPO to try and marry the tools a little bit more for that specific capability.
Great, thanks. This is going to be an interesting one. I'm sure you guys are going to dive at this. How easy will it be to do a rollback from cloud back to on-prem?
Ooh, it's a tough one. Now that depends, because of course we're talking about two very broad environments here. Cloud can be anything from CRM, Power BI, SharePoint, but in the confines of SharePoint, as Sam mentioned, we do have deep partnerships with third-party providers out there that do have tools that allow migrations from on-prem to the cloud, but adversely, they also allow you to do migrations from the cloud to on-prem. So the short answer is, however difficult it was for you to migrate to the cloud, it should be as equal or less difficult to move back if you had to, but I would most certainly hope that you wouldn't.
The key concern is, have you taken advantage of a technology that's
available a good point.
Only in the cloud
yeah.
on SharePoint Online? There are some capabilities that are SharePoint Online only, and when you go back to on-prem, you're going to lose that. That's just got to be an acknowledgement of, hey, if we're going to move back to on-prem, we're going to lose this capability.
Yeah, much like Jonathan Lewis said, when we went from on-prem to cloud, there was a lot of cleanup and a lot of prep work that had to be done. If you do want to migrate from cloud back to on-prem, for instance, there are certain pieces of your company that you identify, okay, we really need to move this back to on-prem. Yeah, there would still have to be some prep work. As Jared said, there could be features leveraged that were specific to Office 365 now that our feature sets are somewhat diverging between on-prem and cloud. You would want to make sure that you take inventory of those and of course, do that cleanup before you move back. It could be difficult or it could be really easy, depending on your circumstances.
It'd be interesting to get more context around that question, because
yeah.
when we were migrating to the cloud, we definitely had to roll sites back. On occasion when we actually really severely broke those sites. So if you're talking about during a migration to the cloud, I think it's a slightly different question.
Definitely a loaded one. It's tricky to answer in full.
And this may shock everyone, we're not planning on rolling back to on-prem anytime soon.
No.
Okay, cool. Do we have any recommendations to securely manage our clients and employees' multiple domains on a single tenant, or is it possible?
So I know we've got a few efforts with Windows Intune. I know it's kind of out of the scope of this showcase. We do use Windows Intune to manage client devices. We also have rolled out multi-factor authentication across all of our O365 service stack. So if you're on an internal site, I guess, behind ADFS, then you don't have to worry as much about the two-factor piece. But if you're Azure AD connected or you're outside of your corporate environment and you're interfacing with ADFS, we do use multi-factor authentication. Right now, it's a blend of either smart card for the old traditionalists and phone factor and the Windows Azure Authenticator app for the folks that are using some of the new authentication technologies.
Or virtual smart cards.
Or the virtual smart card, absolutely, yeah. We have many ways to prove your identity.
For virtual smart cards, you need a device that will support TPM, which is Trusted Platform Module. Most laptops today do actually support that, so it works really well there. Obviously, on your phone, most of them probably don't support it. So we do have the phone factor authentication that actually works really well. I use it quite often.
Great. Hopefully a quick question here, because I want to take a quick moment to thank you. We've got lots of questions up here, so we'll see if we can get through as many of these as possible. Is the site archiving something we need to configure, or is it a built-in feature?
That was referring back to you. Yeah, it's a built-in feature. So the site recycle bin, I should step back a bit. All the stuff we talked about, auto sites, the three strikes Jonathan Lewis brought up, that's all stuff that's internal to what MSIT wrote. The site recycle bin, automatically configured, you can take advantage of it today. Anything that gets removed from that site recycle bin is what gets archived under the retention. That would be something that you don't have to configure, but you would have to request from the Office 365 product group using your standard service request process. Depending on the customer, that may be submitting a service request within the O365 admin portal, or it may be engaging a Microsoft Premier technical account manager. Either way, anything that you need to get outside of the standard recycle bin construct, you can request, but you don't have to do any configuration on your side for that. The only other piece that I know in relation to archiving is litigation holds. That you would have to configure on a per OneDrive basis, per mailbox basis. So.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to skip forward to a question and then we'll go back. Are you using the site collection closure delete policy or an external workflow?
Sounds, if I'm understanding the question correctly, this is related to the AutoSites tool that we use, and it's an external workflow running in Azure.
Right.
Okay. If the site collection owner email address no longer exists and bounces back, do you call the organization to update the owner? Ooh. Now, I'm guessing you in this context here is, or context is the Office 365 team. Do we get notified if the email address no longer exists and bounces back?
No.
But we.
So that's the short answer. So our approach to this one, so I'll answer this in a different way. So you've heard us bring up auto sites, and maybe you're even sick of it by now. One of the things that auto sites does is it goes through and ensures that every site collection has at least two valid site collection owners. So the idea is, every time we renew, we enforce, that there's at least one FTE, which is a full-time employee, person configured as a site collection admin. And by making sure that every user is valid, then we avoid the worst of the, hey, this email is no longer valid. Is that answering the right question, do you think, guys, or do you have
yep.
something to drop in?
The only thing I was going to say is it's probably slightly different for OneDrive for Business. I do believe that when somebody leaves the company, the manager does get access to their OneDrive data to make sure that there's nothing really important out there that could get deleted. So
yeah, and,
slightly different there.
And there was a recent issue that we discovered internally on that one where that wasn't working as expected, but it's at least here at Microsoft, where we discovered the problem. I think it was just us that was impacted by this one, but it's working as designed now.
Yep.
Okay. It wouldn't be a conversation without InfoPath being brought up. So, do you use things like InfoPath for forms applications or code CSR en masse?
Short answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we still have a lot of people use InfoPath. We know that InfoPath is being, I guess, deprecated, I guess is the best word.
It's supported through, I think it's 2024?
It's definitely going through the standard Microsoft Office support lifecycle. Yes, even at Microsoft, even when we have things that we're kind of phasing out, we have a lot of employees that will insist on using it right until the very last day that the lights go dark. So definitely still have a lot of CSR, still have a lot of InfoPath. We're hoping that by introducing new things like Office Forms that our employees will naturally adopt those and gravitate, but we know that come the end of the light and lights go out, there are still going to be people using it, and even surprised that InfoPath went away. So, yeah, short answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah, I think the story there is similar to SharePoint Designer. A lot of the things that InfoPath does, can do, aspects of those are now being done, in some cases, a lot better in other tools. So, we're trying to, between here and 2024, come up with a way that not only keeps us on par, but makes it an even better experience to do it in another way.
That's a problem for future us to figure out.
Yeah, 2024 seems like a long way off, doesn't it?
Yes,
exactly.
Okay, let's see if we can get a few more of these. So for SharePoint API, CSOM, JSOM versus REST, I'm going to change the question a little bit. It says, what's the Microsoft preference? And I say, what's your preference?
So what I'm seeing within a lot of Microsoft IT is utilization of REST. It's a preferred API methodology, can be utilized a little bit better. The great thing about SharePoint, though, is we can use either.
Yeah.
It's a personal preference or a team preference rather than a best practice.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing about the way SharePoint has been taking a look at the whole developer model, is to give as much openness to tools so that people can use Angular, they can use JavaScript, they can use whatever they want.
Whatever fits their style.
Exactly.
And the drop-in I would have there, too, is there's some really exciting developments in the Microsoft Graph space, the Office
yes.
Graph space.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be, if you wanted to hit this API, you had to go find out where this lived, and there'd be another one over here and another one over here. If you have a second, go to graph.microsoft.io, where there's a lot of documentation. And really, the big feature here is you can access everything from site collections down to an individual doc level to even items inside of documents right from Graph. Yep. And they're all in one place, one-stop shop. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to do a lot of things that you used to do via all these disparate sources. So I think in an oblique way, that would be one answer to this question as well.
Yeah, it comes down to every one of those is a tool. And there isn't a perfect tool or one that we prefer. Office Graph is a popular one for many of the reasons Sam mentioned. Office Graph, the key is that it is the Office Graph API and that it pulls a lot of aspects of Office 365. So speaking to the Office 365 automation that we do, Graph API is the one I personally leverage because it allows me not only to interact with SharePoint, it lets me interact with Exchange. It lets me grab every aspect of a user profile from AAD and SharePoint. So depending on what type of top-level automation that I'm doing, it gives me kind of that bird's eye view to pick and choose the different building blocks that I need to kind of provide a seamless automation experience. And then, of course, the REST API, we use that occasionally to grab things like the new Exchange photo data. So if we need to get high-resolution photo picks, I'll use the REST API, but I will put it into a C# application where I'm predominantly grabbing the Office API. So much like building a house, we're using multiple tools. I don't think I have anyone that I prefer, just one that I leverage the most, which is Office Graph API.
What's our best practice on displaying over 5,000 items on a list? Do you increase the limit or break into separate lists?
Well, I think this is the same guidance we've been given for years, which is index columns, use subfolders,
different views. That
different views, yeah. Customized views, so you're not trying to show all 5,000 at once.
Exactly.
The 5,000 limit is still there, and it's something we all live with. But you can make it work for you if you're clever about it.
You can work around it.
Yes.
But it's still something probably shouldn't do, as far as having a full 5,000.
Okay. What's the best code base to develop Azure-hosted apps which will be scalable?
Well, the best code base, and I'll jump in and take this, especially
absolutely.
With the Azure. The best code base is what you want to use. The great thing about the new Service Fabric in Azure is you can utilize the Service Fabric in almost any language that you want to your preference. The key thing is to make sure and design your service to properly scale and think about it in the term of microservices, smaller little services versus larger, more monolithic. The smaller services that you have, you can then scale each one individually, which is wonderful when you think about it. You can have you can have one aspect of your system, maybe it's pulling information from Graph. And, that all of a sudden gets used a lot by all aspects of your application. That can grow as it needs and then shrink when it's not in use. And that's the best way I tell people to start developing in Azure. Start at the microservice scale. I know Mark Marcinovich has talked a lot about microservices, especially when it comes to containers, that sort of thing. It is the future of development, especially on the Azure platform, and I highly recommend it. And the great thing about this microservice world is you can then connect to other services, like the Office Graph, like being able to connect into APIs into Skype for Business, or into OneDrive, or whatever those capabilities are that you're looking for.
Okay. Do we use Yammer or Office 365 groups? This should be a simple answer.
Both.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Yes. Just yes.
I think... You know, the one key takeaway, hopefully, that you're hearing from us is here at Microsoft, we in IT don't enforce any way for someone to do their business. We make tools available. We allow them to create sites and then develop solutions on top of those sites. We only get involved where we're asked or where a policy has been bent a little too far. So we don't consider ourselves here to be in the way of end users. We let them find the tool that works for them.
Yeah, and that's a very key, actually a key unique position that puts us in, mostly because we like to be able to observe what our employees are doing and what they gravitate towards. If for instance, we start seeing a sudden pull away from Yammer or a steep decline in usership, it does give us valuable feedback or perhaps a point of investigation, find out why are people leaving it? Is there one of our other technologies that they're gravitating towards? It gives us a very unique insight that the product group just eats up. So we don't try to, I guess we basically don't try to create dams and we don't try to create flow. We try to let our employees basically leverage all our tools. I think our job is to provide them with the knowledge and training and any sort of advice that they need.
Right.
But the idea is to kind of step back and say, you guys do what you need to do. You find the tools that speak to you the most. And we're going to watch and understand from a top level what you're using and why, and hopefully use that for product improvement.
Exactly. Like you said, we're more of the advisor role in that scenario, for sure.
I'm going to try and squeeze in maybe one more question before we have to wrap up, because we're getting close to 10 o'clock. Forms, for those of us not proficient in JavaScript, should we be learning Power Apps?
me as kind of looking at it from the dev side, and I think Darren's going to say a thing. I think it's a great opportunity for no-code development is Power Apps.
Absolutely.
Not only do you get the Power Apps running in potentially in web browser, but you also have the capability to start looking at even mobile apps that you can deploy onto various mobile environments. And it makes it very easy. You can focus on the business logic and the forms themselves without having to deal with the code base.
Yeah, it's a very Power Apps is very empowering. And being one of the engineers here at Office 365, I really do encourage people to learn Power Apps because it does empower them to do a lot more and rely on engineering a lot less, which is a great thing because it means you can design your apps your way and not have to worry about too much engineering oversight or having to work with too many teams, and it can really improve your product churnout time.
One of the last things I would say on that, the great thing about tying into Power Apps and into the platform on SharePoint is then you can tie into the graph and into things like Delve. Mm-hmm. And that information is all together and easily searchable across a broad spectrum, which makes it even easier to bubble up information, I would say.
Right. Okay, so we're getting near the end of our hour, so we're going to have to wrap this up here. You should be able to see another poll question on your screen. Please take a moment to let us know what you think about our IT Showcase webinars. As we wrap up, I want to ask each of our SMEs one final question, and I want to get them to keep their answers as brief as they can for these. Each of you have worked with SharePoint for a while now. What's the one key takeaway you would like our customers to leave with today? So we'll start on this side.
Yeah, I think if I was to encourage everyone in the audience, go to blogs.office.com. We've announced a ton of new stuff this week at Ignite. It's very exciting. And if I was to pick on one technology, go look at Office Graph and all the things you can do with the Office Graph framework.
Right. The biggest takeaway I have that I like about SharePoint Online is that I get to work from bed from any device. Whether or not it can connect to a corporate VPN, they still make it possible. So it's very liberating.
Right.
That's all I got.
It's nice to see you're not in your pajamas.
Yeah, they made me put clothes on.
I guess one of the key takeaways for myself is as we move to the cloud is to embrace that change. One of the biggest things that I've been able to do is I had a slight change in job moving to not just cover SharePoint but Azure, but Darren and I both had major job changes, if you will, from administering servers and making sure patches are done to now administering business processes, or I'm in a different position because I chose to be in a different position to move to the cloud, help Microsoft move to the cloud. So it's embrace that change. It's not going to be a negative. It's going to be a positive thing.
John.
All right. Save the best for last. For me, when I think about moving to the cloud and those folks, this is really more at those folks who are moving to the cloud. I think it's extremely important to make sure you understand your on-prem environment as you're going, or at least first. And find out how many sites you have out there that are just vanilla, smaller sites. Those are easier to migrate. Put those at the front of your migration list. The ones that are heavily customized, you will run into problems. And move those to the very back. So we kind of took a crawl, walk, run. We crawled at first. We got maybe 5 site collections a night. At peak, we were closer to 300. And then as we got towards the end of the list and had those hard rocks to move, then we were kind of back to 5 a night. But clean up, make sure that you take this advantage to clean up your environment. It's the perfect time for doing that.
We have some additional questions that we're going to try and get through. How do you handle security maintenance in SharePoint with respect to onboarding new people and mapping them to their access role that they need? And a follow-up is this centralized via IT or trusted to the business?
It's trusted to the business, yeah. When a new employee onboards at Microsoft, we enable them with all the basic licenses and access that they'll need. When it comes to specific security permissioning, I believe kind of as a rite of passage, we have the employees work with their immediate team to get into the security groups that they need. They have to go through the same access requests for any sort of internal software that they might need access to. We do try to streamline that with some internal tools that do look at your org and determine if we make it easier or harder for you to get access to certain things. But it is basically down to the end user and his immediate team to get them the security that they need to do their job.
And we've had some interesting discussions around adding like just-in-time access to the mix. Has that moved forward any? Any further?
Yeah. So we do have just in time. We have a secure administrative workstation model where anybody who's a high risk administrator, somebody who has immense access to the company, we get these workstations that allow us to work securely. That piece is identified and automated based on the security groups that we get approved for. And then, of course, with Office 365, we've just rolled out the Azure Privileged Identity Management model that, one, still has a manual application process. People still have to manually apply, go through business justification. But once there, the automation kicks in, and they can elevate for 4 to 8 hour spurts depending on the access they need.
But that's limited to a certain set of admins here.
Very small set of admins, yeah.
Right. But I think just adding on for the regular users, the businesses that we support, we leave it to them to add users
Absolutely.
To SharePoint sites, to add users to security groups, and they can optionally participate in dynamic security groups. So by joining a certain organization, reporting up to a certain leader, then they can automatically get added to security groups.
Right.
So.
Okay, next question. How do you create dynamic digital forms when InfoPath is not an option anymore?
Well, currently InfoPath still is an option. There is going to be some new technology they're still working on coming out. I would also say Power Apps is another way to do dynamic digital forms as a creation tool. And like I said before, with Power Apps, you can not only create it for the cloud, but you can also create it for apps running on mobile devices. So that's going to be a real critical help for a lot of customers, that they can make mobile apps that can take advantage of their SharePoint data.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, InfoPath forms are still usable at this point. They won't be completely deprecated until 2024, but I wouldn't wait too long to start finding a new option, like the one that Jared mentioned.
And of course, we've got Office Forms in preview. So Office Forms is another option. And definitely, because it's in preview, we are definitely welcoming customer feedback, trying to get more of a sense of what they do and do not use it for, pain points. Mm-hmm. Now's the time to use Office Forms because you have a direct inroad with our product groups to make that product better and expand its feature set.
Great. So sharing documents and sharing sites with external users, will it stay?
I would probably say yes. Yeah. In fact, it's going to get bigger with the addition of the capabilities in Azure AD of the B2B, the business-to-business, as well as the business-to-customer, B2C type trusts that can be created. As companies set up more of the B2B connections, we can actually then share our data with companies we work with directly, and the other business users are using their credentials from their company.
So we're expanding the external user story as well to other products like CRM. So there will be external access scenarios. So I think you're right. It's not going away. It's just getting bigger.
It's going to get it's
CRM, Power BI, I think, is also going to be getting it to a lot of the cloud services.
Announced just this week at Ignite is the ability to share a folder, not just an individual item. So this is a space definitely getting bigger, not smaller.
Exactly.
Terrific. Okay, so our next question. Will provider-hosted apps running on SharePoint Online get the permissions necessary to access Azure Active Directory groups to query users within that group? Currently, these apps can't query Azure AD groups.
This is a problem that we've run into, actually, within Microsoft IT. We've provided feedback to the Azure team around this and the SharePoint product group. There are some settings that you can set to help it, but yes, there is a gap there, for sure.
Sums it up, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is data retention of deleted sites or site collections available to all customers in Office 365?
Yes. It
through
is.
Through the proper channels.
So definitely. It's going to vary from customer to customer. But if for any reason, data from your recycle bin goes stale and expires and gets flushed out of your recycle bin, by all means, reach out through your proper support channels, either a service request in the Office 365 portal for most of you, or through your Premier TAM. And we'll definitely look into recovering that data. But it's available to all customers.
Correct.
Great.
Don't be afraid to ask.
A lot of our sandboxes solutions crashed recently. What is the stopgap which can buy us some time?
And I'm guessing this is around Office 365 or on-prem. Yeah, it's a partially trusted code. Mm-hmm. I know in Office 365, they're actually shutting off a lot of that so that it won't work anymore. So you really need to get to a cloud app provider model quickly. I would say that for both on-prem and for cloud, the stopgap on-prem would be to switch it to fully trusted code in the short term, which would get you at least the app working again, but I would highly recommend moving to the cloud app model as fast as possible.
Okay, a couple of AutoSites questions. Do you maintain metadata about your sites and collections outside of SharePoint to drive governance? Does your AutoSites tool have its own database, for example?
Yes.
Absolutely.
We do maintain a lot of compliance data, HBIs, LBIs, MBIs, site owners. We do maintain that in an Azure-based database, actually. Mm-hmm. We do maintain that so that we can review sites and collect telemetry off of it.
And we do quite frequently do that. We actually do tap into that data quite frequently.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Great. With the deployment of Office 365 groups and team sites, have you aborted the use of AutoSites workflow?
Yeah, so the answer here is we have switched. Right now, we are using out-of-the-box provisioning methods to provision group sites, groups-based SharePoint site collections.
Right.
For users who want to provision traditional team sites, as we still call them, at least internally, then you still go through the AutoSites process. Mm-hmm. Now, the difference there is, if you go through the team sites creation process, we apply all the necessary governance stuff, the HBI, MBI, LBI, and whatnot, at site creation time. If you provision via the out-of-the-box mechanism, then AutoSites scans, finds the unclassified site, and does that as a post-creation operation. So I think that's the answer to this one.
I think that's right.
Okay. Let's go to our next question. How are you governing or expiring Office 365 groups and teams?
I believe we are at the moment. I believe lifecycle management is a discussion that we're still working on. I believe right now the deleting piece is up to the administrators. If they're not using their Office 365 group, they can delete it. When it comes to lifecycle management, I know that is still a piece that we're still discussing.
Yeah, the way I'd term this one. So our standard process when you create a SharePoint legacy team site collection is that site was good for 6 months. So we're kind of provisioning groups now with the idea that within 6 months from now, then we'll have a better story here around it. We're taking a very careful approach here, because in the notion of a group is you've got this construct that works across so many different pieces. It's got an email piece, it's got a Yammer piece, it's got a SharePoint piece. And so to go in and delete a group is something we want to make sure we're doing in the proper way with the proper circumspection. So we don't have an answer there yet, but it's something we're working on.
So the next question we have is, changing previous data in a database column, can it be done in the database? For example, change an entry from entry to entry one. So the question is, what is the best way to do this on over 1,000 entries that need changing?
Well, no one should be actually making changes to the database directly. That's a dangerous thing to do with SharePoint. The way to change that would be to do things programmatically, and you can do that either through actually the API, either the SharePoint or the Graph API, or you can even use PowerShell to make changes on a basis to do a large update like that. So I would definitely stay away from trying to change it in the database, because that could just lead to all sorts of problems.
Agreed.
Thanks. And now, is the list lookup limit, has it been updated from the default number of 12 to a higher number in SharePoint 2016? If so, what is it? And what happens if we change the number in 2013 from 12?
I don't know.
I have not seen anything that we are going to be changing the list lookup limit in 2016. I think it's still 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any change in that.
I haven't either.
The good news is, if it does change, it'll be higher.
Yeah.
So if you do have your number already set to the max limit, you shouldn't have to do anything. I certainly don't think we'll be going one lower to 11. But
no.
In that case, then there would be problems. But we never go to 11.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for all of your questions. We hope we've helped answer some of those today. We hope to see you again soon.